Gavel in. This meeting of the House Community Regional Affairs Committee will come to order. Today is Tuesday, March 25th. The time is 8:03. Members present are Representative Clayman, Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Thompson, and myself, Representative Hannon. I'd like, we have a quorum to conduct business, but we are simply going to do a presentation today. Before we begin, I'd like to remind everyone to silence their cell phones. Today, our recording secretary is Lori Rowland, and Madison Truitt is our LIO moderator, assisting with teleconferencing support. Thank you to both of you. My staff, Tim Clark, is our committee aide this morning. If you have notes for others at the table, please pass them through Tim. Today, we will be hearing a presentation on the Alaska Municipal League's concept for a community services fund. It explores ideas to bring greater stability and efficiency in providing for the needs of local governments. Presenting for us today is Niels Andreessen, Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. Mr. Andreessen, if you'll come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed with your presentation, please. Bless you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hannon. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Niels Andreessen. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. And we really appreciate the invitation this morning to talk about this concept of a community services fund and its component pieces. I will preface this by saying, in terms of a concept, and you'll see working draft on a lot of the slides, this is a work in progress. This is an idea that we've tried to flesh out based on years of discussion. I wouldn't say that AML members have come to agreement necessarily around what's in here, but also there's next steps in terms of potential legislation that would give us a better sense of the considerations that legislators might have with respect to this concept. So I'm glad that we're in a safe space here to be able to have a dialogue around the contents of this concept. And there are some portions of the presentation that trend toward philosophical, but I hope that you'll get the point in terms of our ultimate goal, which is to maximize local self-government and leverage local government resources in the public and in the state interest. I know many of you are familiar with the asset that is local governments. They maintain 5,500 road miles, roughly equal to the Department of Transportation. They have a combined spend, just 40 of those local governments have a combined spend on law enforcement that's $75 million more than the entire budget of the Department of Public Safety. At this point, they collect more in taxes than the state of Alaska. They fund 50% of the state's constitutional public education obligation, and they own and maintain 75% of the state's schools. They maintain the majority of libraries, parks, pools, museums in Alaska, and own and maintain the majority of ports and harbors. They're ultimately responsible in their communities for platting, zoning, and platting for half the state. That said, there are certainly challenges facing these communities. I can point to $3 billion in construction and maintenance needs based just on 40 CIP lists that boroughs and home rule and first class cities have provided to us. I can point to $2 billion in school construction and maintenance needs based on Department of Education numbers. I can point to $2 billion in water and wastewater needs based on DEC numbers. We know we face challenges when it comes to local law enforcement, public safety more broadly, including recruitment and retention issues. And over the last three decades, we've seen the erosion of state support, which is contributing to what DCRA at one point was calling stressed communities. And I can point to a list of stressed communities that is the vast majority of 165 cities and boroughs in the state who are struggling to keep the lights on, to respond to and comply with state regulations and statutes. And ultimately, that erosion of state support is challenging because many of these communities have a restricted and varied tax base. Municipalities aren't created equal, and for as much as some do have a tax base that they can deliver essential and increasingly essential services to residents, many struggle to access and leverage their tax base in a way that helps to meet not only resident expectations but the needs of the state.
And let me just note that Representative Drummond joined us at 8:06. Any questions so far for the presenter? Okay.
So the intent of this concept of a community service fund is really responsive to the situation that the state of Alaska finds itself in and has been in for the last 5 years, as well as in response to this sense that local governments have needs that are not being met in relation to their partnership with the state. So the goals of a community services fund, of which a municipal dividend is a component, is to, one, reduce the state's role as an intermediary and to increase local control. And I'll talk more about what that looks like. But essentially, it's places where the state has taken on the role as a middleman between federal and local government, either funding or program management. To connect state funding to services provided, similar to the original revenue sharing program. One of the concepts, and I'm just under 2 years in my position, but one of the areas of pushback that I've seen from lawmakers is really an unsureness about for community assistance. What is the state getting from that? And I think that there's an opportunity to better define the return on state investment. And to connect state funding to essentially state responsibilities, but provided at the local level. One of the goals is to negotiate an increasing number of responsibilities to move from the state to local governments. This is a concept of devolution or subsidiarity, that basically the level of government that is most capable to deliver a service should be the one to deliver that service. And finally, to incentivize the adoption of powers, borough formation, and class upgrades. And really what this is speaking to is that there's, in some instances, there isn't an incentive to become, to incorporate as a city, or to class up within a city or borough, or to take on new powers, that the adoption of new powers comes with cost shifting and a burden that local taxpayers can't take on. So part of the discussion today is to think about all four of these goals in a variety of ways. That said, the concept isn't meant to displace programs that currently collect and share state taxes on local economic activity. So there are good programs in place, petroleum property tax, for instance, or the shared fisheries taxes, where there's a structure in place for the state to act in its role and to redistribute those funds back to local governments. I think we need to continue to reduce the costs of compliance.
Sorry. I'm reading. It's morning. Representative Thompson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Neil Anderson, on that cost of compliance, I have a list that I compiled or got compiled about darn near 3 years ago now, and it's from the schools on mandated, unfunded mandates to the schools, and it's about 30 items listed on there. And I should have brought it down and given you a copy. I don't know if the AML wants to wade in on saying, you know, why are you forcing our schools to do this, because all it does is put a lot of burden on the school districts, and that's why that they have so much administrative costs. I'm sure there's more than just the schools that have problems with unfunded mandates that we put out there. Has your organization, or will they be able to possibly come up with items that they could say, why are you forcing us to do this? It doesn't really help the state any. It doesn't help the community any. Help us review some of those type of mandates that are unfunded.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Thompson, one, I'd be very interested in seeing the school district list. The Alaska Municipal League is also working on a similar list, have had that list in the past. Definitely, I think that's an area where, beyond funding, let's make these things easier for local governments and political subdivisions of the state to be partners.
We'll get you that list. Thank you. Yeah.
Representative Christ-Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be really interested to see that list once it's compiled,
right.
Shared with me, if not the whole committee.
Okay. Do that.
I think so. I think everyone is, you know, many laws get passed and we just keep adding to them without really clearing out the statutes. So I suspect that there are many things that we've asked local governments to do over the last 60 years that may no longer be pertinent. Since we've stopped on this slide, the borough formation question, how far and how much engagement of the dialogue of that has AML ever had with the legislature? I know that here in Southeast, certainly our furthest south first class government has pushed repeatedly for mandatory borough formation. You know, let's organize the unorganized borough, and the legislature legally is to act as the local government for the unorganized borough, but we tend not to exercise that very narrowly. Has the Alaska Municipal League pursued the idea of what it would cost, what kinds of new and competing interests might be formed amongst local governments if we pushed mandatory borough formation? Or is that too broad for AML to have ever pursued very far?
Oh, Chair Hannon, I think it's a good question. I would say that the Alaska Municipal League would oppose mandatory borough formation. On the principle of that this needs to be a locally driven process in terms of taking on both responsibilities and taxation. That said, we do have a resolution passed this last November that requests that the legislature act as the assembly of the unorganized borough and call itself in a session to take on the responsibilities of a borough. And there's three responsibilities of a borough: planning, platting, zoning. There's education powers, which right now you delegate to the Department of Education, and there's taxation. There are three things that the assembly of the unorganized borough is required to do. And the legislature in that form could choose to exercise its responsibilities.
Thank you. It doesn't seem to be much dialogue for that going on around here, but I always like to throw it out as a something to think about.
It's all right.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Andreasen, for this really interesting coverage this morning. You mentioned among the goals are to incentivize the adoption of powers, borough formation, and class upgrades. That would involve cost shifting and burden that local taxpayers can't take on. In some cases, they won't take it on, or they refuse to take it on, as we have seen in the demonstration of trooper service to the somewhat urban and property tax-capable Mat-Su borough, when we're short on troopers all over the state. So I totally agree with that. Let's move some of that burden. I know the Anchorage municipality has been doing a lot of work in that respect. The troopers removed their station from Birdwood. The last couple of years when the Anchorage Police Department has been patrolling from Potter Marsh to Portage, I have seen more police cars than I have ever seen state trooper vehicles on that stretch of road in a summer's drive down the Seward Highway. I think I saw five on one particular day. Anchorage Police Department. Yeah, they came to an agreement with Girdwood and the three separate communities along the way to Girdwood, Rainbow, Bird, and Indian, I think, on taxing themselves, adding themselves to the police service area,
and APD took on the responsibility of patrolling the Seward Highway. I'd be really interested to see what the accident and crash rate and fatality rate has been, because there's definitely more visibility of public safety. There's always the argument of the state roads in Anchorage and maintaining, and right now plowing. There's more snow in Anchorage than I've seen in many years. I just saw this past weekend, and there's always the who's responsible for which streets. And Anchorage has been taking over, for example, sidewalk maintenance adjacent to state roads, because the state just does not consider that there are pedestrians and other strollers and bikers that use the sidewalks adjacent to the state roads.
Right.
So that cost shifting and responsibility shifting has been going on for quite some time. So I appreciate the gentle nudge in that direction.
Thank you, Representative Drummond, through the chair. I think it's an important reason to include the words negotiate and incentivize, right? There's a partnership here where we're talking about what is the relationship between the state and local governments, and how do we shift through discussion state current responsibilities to the local level, mm-hmm. and ensure that we mitigate negative impacts at that local level too. So I think that's really where we'll get to throughout the presentation.
When you're done, please let the record reflect that Representative Jackson joined us at 8:16.
Right. You're back. And I'll just, for this slide, just in terms of what else needs to continue, I think there will always be a basic level of technical and funding assistance necessary for communities. The Constitution calls for very few agencies to be developed, and a Division of Community Regional Affairs or something like it is specifically called for in the Constitution. We saw a $1 million unallocated budget cut to that division last year, which means they have six fewer local government specialists. And I've had members say from small communities and even medium-sized communities that the state of DCRA and the lack of capacity within local government specialists is really harming their ability to operate. At the same level or at the same time for community assistance, we know that when community assistance went away in the early 2000s, communities closed their doors. Local governments ceased to operate without that base level of support, and we'll talk more about that later. So moving on, so those are some of the reasons that get us to this point of a discussion about a community services fund and dividend. There are four types of funds that I'll talk about during this presentation. So one, there are standing funds. These are currently expenses of the state. And most of these were highlighted in last year's budget discussion. Most of these were cut during last year's budget discussion. And when we look at the $1.6 billion deficit in the attempt last year to address that, we saw $900 million shifted to local governments. So that is at the heart of where a lot of these numbers and programs came from. But there's currently expenses of the state. I've highlighted just a couple small ones, the AL Broadband Program that's supporting broadband in communities, the transit matching grants that's helping local governments provide low-cost transit for community members. There's capacity building funds. These are ones that strengthen local governments, and I've talked briefly about community assistance. There's quite a few funds that are transferred funds that where the state is the middleman or the intermediary between either what they're collecting or what the federal government is transferring to the state for local governments as intended recipients. So this is secure rural schools or timber receipts, and then PILT payments through the Department of Interior's payment in lieu of taxes. Finally, we'll talk about devolved funds. So this is compensation by the state for taking on new responsibilities, and we'll talk more about law enforcement. So part of the proposal then would be to move all of these into a community services fund through first fund transfers, and then second through a municipal or community services dividend. And I'll expand on both of those. When it comes to, on slide six, for when it comes to fund transfers and the state acting as an intermediary, there's $140 million held by the state on behalf of local governments. It's held by the state for between 3 to 6 months, roughly. It's held in Jafonzi, the state's general fund account, where it's it might have interest earnings or some investment earnings, but those are minimal. Potentially, those are roughly $1 to $2 million, maybe at current interest rates or investment earning rates. The bulk of these funds that are held by the state, the earnings on those funds do not accrue to the intended recipient. So the state holds on to a federal transfer for as long as it can, earns what it can while it's there, and those earnings stay with the state. The distributions are generally managed by DCRA. And the question for me, and I would say for this committee and for the legislature, is whether this is the most useful use of state resources during a time of fiscal constraint. If there is an intent to or question about the role of state government and a need to respond to a fiscal deficit, is there a better way to approach this than the current system? And ultimately, I think for local governments, the question is this consistent with the intent of those funds? If the intended recipient is a local government, then is it in the public interest for the state to hold $140 million for between 3 to 6 months?
Could you expand on what? So these are the federal funds that are like PILT or Secure Rural Schools. What's the reason that the state holds them for so long? Is it just that they regularly do its quarterly transfers, or it's a biannual transfer? Do some other states or jurisdictions do a direct pass-through so there's no lag time? Or
yeah, part of Chair Hannon, I think to the question, I think there are a number of different reasons. We've tried to determine kind of what the root causes are. It turns out Alaska is different than other states. You'll be surprised to know. Some of this is because there's an unorganized borough, and the federal government, or at least through the Forest Service for Secure Rural Schools and for PILT, the state acts because it acts as the intermediary for or the assembly of the unorganized borough. It comes first to the state for distribution of those communities. There's no real reason, though, that those communities aren't already identified and their appropriation levels already indicated. So, essentially, it's state policy that the state accept those funds and redirect them. It could be just as easily the state's policy not to, and that those funds go directly to intended recipients. Yeah.
Did you have a question, Representative Jackson? Go ahead.
Through the chair, so say we say potentially there's earnings $1 to $2 million that could be sent down to local communities. How many local communities are we talking about? And would you want that evenly distributed?
Okay. So right now, and maybe I'll just move to the next slide so you can see what these funds look like. So here's a list of the different funds that we identified where the state acts as an intermediary. Just a few of these are federal. Most of them are state activity that's accepting state taxes or fees, and it's in statute that the state should direct those back to local governments. Between all of these, this impacts every local government. And there's formulas in statute for how they are allocated to intended recipients. So it would impact 165 cities and boroughs. It wouldn't be spread out evenly. It would be spread out according to, or it is spread out right now according to those formulas. It could be calculated and given directly to those local governments. Or we'll propose through this community services fund, which would reduce the lag time.
Go ahead.
Sorry, through the chair.
It's okay.
I think I missed that.
Follow up through the chair. So I can imagine how that would get if we tried to do this, and not to say we won't, but like you were just saying, different boroughs and not get so much, a certain percentage. When the money comes into the state, it comes in from the federal government in a lump sum, and it's our responsibility to divvy it out. Do you think this could be done and fairly without us, you know, getting in the middle of, you know, that was supposed to be mine?
Right. Through the chair, Representative Jackson. So, I mean, I would say that, you know, to some extent, at the heart of the question of why does it currently go to the state and why is there lag time is because of your power of appropriation. I think to a large extent, these are already in statute in terms of the formula for distribution. So early on in the year, Department of Revenue says, here's what we have available. So you already know what the money is going to look like. And there's already a statute on the other end that says, here's where the money's going to go. You hold on to it so that in the budget process, you can say, we recognize this revenue on the one hand, and we will do what the statute says on the other.
Thank you. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. I would also just note that there are a number of different capacity building funds out there. We talked about, I'll come back to a senior citizen, the tax exemption, but community assistance, we already talked about. There's $60 million in that fund. There can be as much as $90 million in the community assistance program fund. The original community revenue sharing was a precursor to community assistance. You know, reimbursed for road miles, police, additional services. That program's been reduced from $180 million in 1985 to $30 million in 2015. It provides base amounts for boroughs, cities, and community associations. I would note that the veto of the recapitalization of that fund this year means that the fund, instead of being at $90 million, is at $60 million. The payment in FY21 will be reduced by a third. So it'll be $20 million instead of $30 million that goes out, and everybody will go down to their base level. So the municipality of Anchorage, instead of getting $4.5 million, will get $300,000. And the Fairbanks North Star Borough, instead of getting $1.5 million, will get $300,000. So anywhere where there's population, you'll see the per capita amounts basically reduce the community assistance by that. There's also power cost equalization. There's $1.13 billion in that fund. Again, you're holding that fund, holding onto that fund to be able to pay out according to statute. And the fund reduces transaction costs and the cost of energy for over 100 communities, but levels the playing field for those communities. I would just note, so the reimbursement for the senior citizen and disabled veteran property tax exemption has been in place for 20, 25 years. It has not been reimbursed since 1997. The value of that required mandate by the state, I guess those are the same thing. The value of that mandate by the state, if we want to talk about unfunded mandates, is $90 million. It impacts 40 municipalities, anybody that has a property tax. That means $90 million less that they have available to provide services required by the state. It also means that that amount is made up by other taxpayers in those jurisdictions. The statute's pretty clear that you shall, the legislature shall appropriate that funding, though it does give provide for some wiggle room in terms of if there's not enough to cover it, then it will be distributed pro rata. So you could say that if you have zero available, that it's zero that you distribute.
Representative Clayman.
So is that another example of a statute that we're supposed to spend a certain amount of money or disperse a certain amount of money, but if we don't have it, we don't spend it?
Yeah, but it's through the chair. Yes, Representative Clayman. Yes, kind of. I mean, most say may, or some say if based on appropriation. This gives you some. Thank you. This says pretty clearly shall, and it but then it says if there's not funding available, then it'll be distributed pro rata. So this is one of the higher levels, higher level unfunded mandate type aspects.
Representative Clayman?
So it's a little bit not exactly in track with where you are on the presentation, but I guess one of the queries I have is if a chunk of these funds are distributed by the state now according to certain formulas when there's money available, and if there's less money, then the formula dictates less money. What is the efficiency gained by having a third party doing the distribution and basically following the same statutory formula that's in law as opposed to just having the state do it?
Yeah.
What are we getting? Where's the improved efficiency here?
Sure. Representative Clayman, through the chair, hopefully we can get to that through the rest of these slides, because I'd like to build to an argument for that.
Yeah. I'll wait.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to indulge on the senior citizen reimbursement just for, you know, as a freshman. Certainly as a local property taxpayer, I haven't been able to take advantage, but I know that, you know, the demographics tell us seniors are the largest growing demographic in Alaska, so more and more municipal impact of this. 1997, we still had a fair amount of money, but we did away with that. Has there been much dialogue at the state level, push from the municipalities to reinstate this reimbursement, or is it just laid, you know, there was a skirmish when it went away, but has it not been an annual fight from the local governments to demand the legislature fulfill this statutory mandate? Or so to my colleagues who've been here through that, is it?
I haven't heard a word.
Representative Price Tompkins.
The only time I think I've heard about it is when AML is testifying. I think highlighting this is not to take us down a rabbit hole, but when we talk about the PFD formula, it's like there's half a dozen statutes that are highly substantive that the state has ignored for a decade or multiple decades. And so I'm generally of the mind that we should probably follow the laws that we have, ideally. But I think there's sort of like a selective indignance when it comes to the PFD, because I mean this statute has been around since 97. So, but I've never heard. I mean, I think either, you know, repeal it and allow municipalities to make the decision, or and I feel that way with the PFD. I mean, we should rewrite the formula. Anyway, sorry to insert that in the conversation.
Yeah, Representative Jackson.
To the chair, I'm asking for clarity. Like, are you talking about the tax exemptions for the seniors?
Yes.
Follow up. I was in Sitka 2 years ago, and the seniors were up in roar about losing those exemptions.
But
is that what you're talking
about?
Well,
this is property tax exemption. Yes. I think
that's what I'm talking about.
I think it was
about
sales tax. They were up in
sales tax.
Right.
Because seniors do have that exemption up to a certain amount. Is that correct?
Right.
That's a local decision.
Right. The property tax.
Property.
Yeah.
Property.
And that's where the state law says, and I think it's 100,000 or is it 150?
120.
150. 150 property tax forgiveness. But when that statute was in place, and I'm not actually sure when it started, the state replaced that lost property tax value to municipal governments. But in 1997, the state stopped funding that mandatory exemption from property tax, but kept the mandate that you give it to local property owners.
So your query is, what have we seen in terms of lobbying down here on the part of municipalities effectively saying make this a higher priority to repay? And I generally agree with Representative Price Tompkins that the Municipal League brings it up, occasionally municipalities bring it up, but part of the challenge, and this is where I only understand the structure of the Anchorage property tax payments and kind of what happens to the municipality, that the deduct the exemptions are a reduction in value for purposes of figuring out the taxing amount that's owed, in the same way that we have a $20,000 exemption for if you live in your home, that you can take the $20,000 off the valuation, and you once you elect it, it continues to apply in future years. But the way that the Anchorage mill rate is calculated, it doesn't result in the loss of property tax revenue to the city. So that if I'm a senior and my house is valued at $350,000 by the appraisers, with the $150,000 exemption, my house has been valued at $200,000 instead of $350,000. And then that $200,000 value is added up with all the other houses in the community and the commercial property and divided into whatever is the total tax base. And the effective result of the reduction is that people who are not seniors pay a somewhat effectively higher rate and, in effect, pay the taxes that I don't pay, but the city actually doesn't lose money, at least in Anchorage in terms of collection. So there's a component in which, and I don't claim to speak on behalf of the city of Anchorage, although I do know when I was acting mayor and we were talking about that, how high is this on our priority list, it was hard to come down in tight times and advocate to the state that you should pay this money to make up the difference, because we couldn't say we were really losing the money, and so we were more interested in prioritizing things like schools and roads that were payments that we didn't have money for, whereas actually the property tax exemption, which is a function of changing who pays and how much and to provide support for our seniors, doesn't cost the city money, so it made it lower on the city's priority list. I'm not sure how that works in Juneau, but I certainly know in Anchorage that I think factors into the municipalities not putting as high a priority on it.
Right, and I understand that it's not a true loss. It's a shift of who in your municipal government is carrying that extra burden. But one of my local governments, Haines, happens to be a community where many of the homes are only valued at $150,000, and their economic plan for the next 10 years shows that not only is over 65 their largest demographic, it is growing exponentially. And so, you know, you could foresee that in 10 years, they're going to have, you know, more than half their tax base is totally tax exempt on property values, because a lot of them are rural properties in a borough valued at $150,000 or less and paying no property tax by state mandate. And then the family of five in town is paying as much in property tax to keep the schools going. But of course, we in this business, the nature of it is we do immediate problem solving and very few long-term policy development questions. We deal with the crisis in front of us. So former Mayor Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I had to make a quick phone call. On that issue, how many seniors would not be able to afford an extended huge property tax and they would leave the state? That's what I'm concerned about with that type of a thought. You know, there's a lot of them out there that do barely get by, and if you quadruple their property tax because your exemption's gone and they're retired, they're going to move out of state, and that's what I would be worried about.
Well, I think,
sorry, Chair, but that is a very important question, the combination of what you both mentioned. And the thing is, their homes are paid for,
yep.
Right? And they're on a fixed income. And so when I heard that cry, it really touched my heart, because they've been there for years. Raise families, raising grandchildren, and may lose their home because they may lose this exemption. Yeah.
I think if I can add to the conversation, Chair. So I think AML's position currently is that the reimbursement should be reimbursed. There's not consensus between 40 mayors and 40 different jurisdictions about the approach the state should take in terms of removing that exemption. I would only say that the best practice nationally is that it should be means-based and not age-based. So that's the position that I've seen from AARP and others. That's maybe a longer-term discussion to have, which I think addresses some of the members' concerns about, for those who need that exemption, what it might do or not.
Okay.
Yeah. So that the two types of funds then that you know we might propose moving into a community services fund would be those transferred funds that are have to be transferred anyways, and then those funds that provide base levels of support. And I think to Rep. Clayman's question about where is there efficiency in moving funds from the state to local control, I think it really depends on what it looks like. So that maybe the devil's in the details, but I think that there are ways to. Our argument would be that we could manage these funds for less cost than the state. We could get them into the hands of local governments quicker, and we could find efficiencies that right now the state's not able to because of the way it's structured within the state between departments. So I think the proposal would be that, I mean, you could transfer all federal and state funds if they're intended for local governments directly into a municipal managed holding account. You could set up within that that process that those funds, for any interest or earnings they accrue, they go to the intended recipients. The funds are managed according to state or federal statute or regulations, and we already do that for, I'll talk about AMLIP, the AML investment pool. It's in statute. Here's your investment criteria, and it's pretty straightforward for how to manage those funds while they're there. I think we can streamline grant administration, and I'm suggesting here that AML could do this, but would actually set up a separate kind of interlocal governance structure. The investment interest earnings then distributed according to how you want to do it, and essentially pays for the administration. There's no cost to a community services fund necessarily. It could come from what comes out already from those earnings. I mentioned AMLIP, the AML investment pool. This has been in statute for a long time, basically enables or empowers local governments to pool resources for short-term investments. So it's an active money market account similar to Jafonzi. But you could expand its ability to invest into medium and long-term investments. And basically replicate the structure of the PCE investment guidelines, which are pretty simple and straightforward. You could develop formulas, or there are formulas established in law that are already applied to distribution. And this separate third party could, you know, have separate accounting for all the funds consistent with the state law. But this does, it eliminates the state as that intermediary, it increases the distribution speed, and it ultimately reduces the footprint of state government. And I think that's where we get to efficiencies, Representative Clayman. I think that, one, for as many different funds as I noted earlier in terms of what's being distributed, there's a form to fill out for all of those. There's a reporting mechanism for all of those. And I think if it was consolidated into a third party, you would find some efficiency in being able to report quickly and apply quickly for those funds, where application is even necessary. And I think that's something that a third party could do. This also, I mean, you can think of it in terms of a public-private partnership where somebody, a third party outside of state government, may have different guidelines for staffing and costs that than the state might have. Continue. So that's... So this keeps you in a place where you can maximize your lawmaking authority, even though it you can think of it in terms, too, of reducing your appropriation ability. I don't know that that's completely straightforward or true, But I think there's a strong argument that at the very least you retain those powers even as we move things to externally managed funds. I think this helps to maximize local control and local self-government so that the intended recipients of these funds are actually managing them and managing them not only to your guidelines or statutes, but in their interest. And it keeps the state having a strong oversight role even as it moves things off the state's books. So that, in a lot of ways, is step one. I think that's an easier argument maybe than a community services or municipal dividend. But I think the governance structure applies to both. Basically, an interlocal entity that is managing either transferred funds or block grants according to statutes or guidelines set out by the state. So community dividend, many of you have heard of for the last 30 years, maybe. It's been around as a concept for a while, but it recognizes that the state is a resource owner, that the state preempts local governments from taxing those resources, and that there's a distributive ability at the state level that doesn't exist at a local level. A community services dividend builds on this idea of partnership between local governments and the state, such that the local governments have a role in taking on responsibilities that the state has and delivering services to Alaskans. And finally, I would say that it suggests that community needs are addressed, which maximize an individual PFD. That if you can bring down costs at the local level, that if you can put more responsibility at a local level, that citizens have a more direct input into how those dollars are being spent within those budgets. And you see, you know, road maintenance, energy costs, housing, et cetera, come down in a way that's beneficial then to individuals in Alaska. Get a little bit philosophical probably on the PFD, but we'll talk more about it. So it's been around for years. Governor Wally Hickel talked about a community dividend in the 1980s. His suggestion was that it was instead of or in addition to the individual PFD. He suggested that earnings from the permanent fund would be distributed to local governments and set aside for things like schools, ports, hospitals, basically community infrastructure to do community dividend development. And again, basically that the ability to bring down costs in communities was for him more important than putting cash in people's hands. I don't want to speak for the governor, but something like that. Carl Moses also had a community dividend. He had legislation drafted, and it was moving early in the 2000s. This was at a time when the state faced a similar budget deficit. His proposal was to establish a municipal dividend fund, and that fund would basically grant out monies so that you could so that local governments could take on more. This was, I think, related to public safety and kind of key features that the state thought were important. So it was more related to original revenue sharing. His calculation was that it would be an amount equal to lesser of the amount calculated by multiplying $100 by the number of PFDs or the balance of the earnings reserve. We're in a different situation today than maybe back in the 1980s or 2000s. But it's certainly true that, I mean, Hammond also had a community dividend approach in Diapering the Devil when he's talking about a POMV. There were three pieces to Hammond's plan. It was a POMV, which is currently in place. It was an income tax, and it was a community dividend. And it was those. It was that combination of things that actually, for him, helped to meet the needs in Alaska. But you can see, again, that he's in Diapering the Devil. He talks about they're being carved out from a POMV, an amount that goes to individual dividends. And an amount that would be available for community dividends. And he had talked to Mark Begich, who was mayor at the time, and who said that this would bring immediate relief to property tax and help, at least for Anchorage, and we argue for other local governments, the ability to bring down local taxes and take on new services. A different time when they were talking about this POMV approach, but the community dividend concept has been out there for decades at this point. So we could talk about a community dividend in relation to the current POMV draw, and that I know some have suggested that 50% of the POMV draw should go to state government and 50% should go to an individual PFD. I think Ledge Finance has said that that would still break you as a state in terms of your budget, that 75-25 might make more sense, or whatever that looks like. But this concept basically fits into the discussion being held right now by the legislature about how to use the POMV and what is the appropriate allocation between state and an individual PFD. I am not commenting on an individual PFD or changes that should be made to that allocation. I'm just situating community dividend in that conversation, if I can get away with that.
Representative Jeff, we'll see.
Right.
Thank you, through the chair. Let's talk about that. So, right?
Sure.
Okay, so.
Through the chair.
Through the chair, there's talk of a 30-70 split, right? That 70, 35 go to community and 35 go to state. I don't think I've heard any conversation about that. But if you're saying that the communities will use it properly and may lower property taxes or however you see fit, but make sure the community has and get what it needs so the people spend less and enjoy life more. I'm just saying that out loud. So that is here because I have not heard a discussion about that. So.
Through the chair, Representative Jackson, yes. I think that should be part of the conversation, and I think it's something along those lines that we're suggesting, that between and around that allocation, and I mean, there's 40-40-20, or there's, I mean, you pick the percentage based on how you want to allocate those resources. To a large extent, you're already allocating those resources to local government within the state budget, and this is just carving out some intentionality around that. So the percentage matters only in terms of what's available then for local governments for this devolution. But it's definitely a political conversation to have. So we've placed this in context of a POMV draw. You could take it out of a POMV draw or disassociate it from a dividend and say 30% of state tax revenue right now, which is almost entirely oil tax revenue, but it would be at about the same amount for now. So again, the justification for having this conversation is that it does reduce the state's allocation. Though in a lot of ways it's just being intentional about what the state is already allocating to local governments. It identifies and directs funding for state priorities, which is somewhat there, but this clarifies that. It enhances local decision making. I won't speak for the governor, but the governor, was with AML last week and spoke to us and said, the vision is that at some point, in his 10-year plan, it says local issues should be dealt with locally. And AML's position is, yes, if local governments are appropriately funded. And this provides sustainable funding mechanism and continued control. I don't think we can get away from a conversation that this does reduce the individual PFD allocation, which is already part of the conversation. But there's a benefit maybe, and I think Representative Jackson, you spoke to that, that this means that local governments can keep the local essential services that residents depend on. This helps to avoid and might decrease taxes at the local level. It's at the local level where, you know, the PFD recipients are talking to their mayor and their assembly member and their school district folks. What are they called? Board members daily and in the grocery store. And right, so that communication is happening more frequently at the local level, and local resources then respond more directly to Alaska residents, which in my mind means that there's an increased role for Alaskans in state spending to the extent that that's apportioned to local governments. So here's a here's what could go into this. And I mean, if we build off that 20%, these are last year's numbers, it would, and probably proposed budget numbers at some point. So that 20%, if there's $586 million, this doesn't add up necessarily to $586 million, but this gives you some broad guidelines for what could be included. And I'll talk about each of these. School bond debt match. We'll talk about port and harbor improvements, community assistance, road and rural airport maintenance, law enforcement, community jails, deferred building and K-12 maintenance, the senior citizen property tax exemption reimbursement, and then water and wastewater upgrades. These are some of these you're already spending money on, so this formalizes that. Some of these you're not, so this incentivizes the adoption of powers that, you know, for instance, response to Representative Drummond's comment earlier about law enforcement. So these are numbers that would have to be negotiated. These are kind of buckets that made sense in terms of how, when we were trying to flesh this out, what it would look like, we had to come up with formulas for how that distribution could look. So for you have right now a school bond debt reimbursement program, or you don't have a school bond debt reimbursement program right now. That's one funding mechanism for school construction and major maintenance. Then you also have a school construction and major maintenance grant program. The state right now is choosing not to fully reimburse for the school bond debt reimbursement program. But you also see, you know, what last year was $100 million obligation reduced to just under $43 million in around 5 years. So there's an opportunity to, instead of a reimbursement program, to develop for the state's obligation to school construction and major maintenance, a way to have some of it grant funded, but also the state to bond for its portion of those projects and to reform that entire program for how to deliver on the state's constitutional obligation. So we've said, you know, maybe that looks like $100 million. That's already what about your spending on school construction and major maintenance. It's just reforming that program. The total need is $1.3 billion, and a question for the legislature and for the state is, you know, what should the state be putting into school construction and major maintenance? $1.3 billion is conservative.
Will you define for me in this context what need means? Yes. So that's not the current bonded debt. That's right. The project needs of schools across the state.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Hannon. So the Department of Education, out of any of the departments, does an amazing job keeping track of what needs look like for school districts. That means they maintain the list of the 1,006 schools that currently exist, 75% of which are owned and maintained by the state. Each school district is supposed to submit their priority list to Department of Education. They maintain a six-year plan. So out of 54 school districts, 16 of them don't currently contribute to that plan. But within that six-year plan, that's where this $1.3 billion in need comes from. It's probably more like $2.3 billion if you look at the average requested amount for the school construction major maintenance, the priority lists that have come out over the last 10 years. This year's FY21 priority list speaks to about $421 million in need. And so if you take that average amount, and it's roughly $300 million, you get to more like $2.3 billion in need.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I was a little surprised to hear that we have just doubled the number of schools in the state. It's more like 515, I think, not 1,006. I'm just curious where that number came from. And your third bullet, two communities drop off in the next 2 years, 5 and 6 to 7 years. What does that line mean?
Yeah. Representative Drummond, through the chair. Department of Education maintains the list of schools. It might extend to facilities, but there are 1,006 facilities that I think generally are schools. I can send you that list. That's where that number comes from. The third bullet, two communities drop off the reimbursement, the school bond debt reimbursement program in the next 2 years, five in the next 6 to 7 years. So out of the 19 municipalities that have bonded for school construction or major maintenance that are on that reimbursement list, they've done so at various intervals over time, and a few of them drop off soon.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Representative Price-Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious, given that there's not any new school bond debt being accepted by the state, that the door is closed for districts that are building new schools, and just pick Mat-Su given the sort of obvious population growth there and presumable associated increase of student enrollment and therefore school need. At present, is the Mat-Su building new schools? And if so, are they paying 100% of that cost?
Through the chair, Representative Christ-Tompkins. I have to be careful about, I don't want to speak for members. I think that you're right that there is need in the Mat-Su. I don't believe that the Mat-Su is currently constructing new schools. I think there's a lot of hope that the moratorium will expire, at which point there would be an opportunity to apply for that program. There's certainly that feeling out there. There's also not a lot of faith in that program. So there are some municipalities that have bonded for new schools or maintenance. I want to say Anchorage and Fairbanks have done that in recent years or during the moratorium, but most don't have that capacity or just waiting for new answers to come forward. Thank you. So this is one bucket of investment that could be included in a community dividend, basically to delineate what is the state's obligation, and the state will still have some responsibility for funding schools, and then through a community dividend, what can you do to offset the 75% of facilities that are owned and maintained by schools or municipalities. The second bucket that we would suggest is Port and Harbor capital improvements. The need here, $600 million, defined in a 2010 study by the Corps of Engineers and Northern Economics, basically a survey to ports and harbors to track need. We're going to update that survey and try to get better numbers for us as we move forward. This doesn't include Port of Alaska, for instance. But I mean, let's say that there's about $600 million in need. Even as there have been investments, there will be new needs created. There's a current Port and Harbor matching grant program, which is utilized somewhat by municipalities. AML members this year passed a resolution in support of this matching grant program. Communities have said that we've got $12.5 million. To put into ports and harbors if the state will match it through this program. We also have an old statute, HB 528, there's DOT debt Basically, school it's a reimbursement program for projects that municipalities bonded for over the last 10 years or 10 years ago. And so there's that. Those are the existing funding mechanisms, as well as any projects within the STIP. But between those two projects and a variety of other projects, the legislature could set out a new way to invest in Port and Harbor for capital improvements. And maybe that looks something like a STIP dedicated to ports and harbors, so that you have a better way of vetting needs. Vetting needs when it comes to port and harbors, there's not a similar structure in place like what DEED has for schools. And how you direct funding outside of those programs or for municipalities is, I mean, you could place it on AMHS ports or an Arctic port network or whatever that looks like. Community assistance, the need here, $304 million. If you inflation adjust the 1985 levels of community revenue sharing, which then was $180 million, you get that basically today's community assistance should be $304 million, which for local governments is significant. So when we talk about eroding state support, that's a big component of it. Basically, we're asking local governments to continue doing all the things that the state has always asked you to do, and we'll reimburse you less for it.
Representative Grace Tompkins.
Thank you. In the first couple of slides, Nils, you mentioned that in past decreases in community assistance had led to shuttering or bankruptcy of incorporated municipalities, and you said you'd get to that later on. I'm not sure when that will be, but the slides on community assistance will ask the question. When did that happen? Which communities are you referring to? How many communities declared bankruptcy? Yeah.
So there's this was the slide I was through the chair. This was the slide that I was going to talk more about that, Representative Grace Tompkins. So there's a good ledge research report related to this. It was back in the early 2000s, and I think I don't know the names of the communities, but they point to eight communities, municipalities that seized operations, and I think 14 that reduced operations. They didn't name them, so I don't know those numbers. But I think the—I mean—for community assistance, if we look at it right now, you know, there's 20 plus out of 165 municipalities for whom community assistance is 80% of their budget. If that's the case, and if community assistance goes away, they will close their doors. There's no way for municipalities to operate on for some of them for on their tax base. I mean, I think that the numbers for the rest of communities, there's maybe 40 that it's a somewhat smaller percentage. But as soon as you get into ranges of 30 to 60%, it means they're probably reducing their staff by half, eliminating core programs, and just unable to function in ways that are currently being expected. So we're not going to, I think we'll see some of those decreases if community assistance isn't further funded for FY21. That $10 million reduction for FY21 won't impact smaller communities as much, but it's that small to medium-sized local government where they're going to have to eliminate programs to be able to make up for it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious with community assistance. It's my observation that there are a number of very, very small communities that totally agree have limited tax base, like de minimis tax base, but also a sort of subset of those communities that haven't made any effort to collect revenues, like kind of period, and do have the means, and that's always sort of struck me. And, I mean, as you described, community assistance ends up being the lion's share, 75, 80, 80 plus percent of their municipal budget. And not that that ratio is problematic, but what I have perceived as a lack of desire to raise local revenue and put skin in the game has always been something that just kind of has struck me. To your knowledge, has there ever been discussion about community assistance being married with an incentive or requirement for local revenue? And not that the absolute amount of local revenue has to be substantial, but that there is an effort or a structure to do it.
Okay. Representative Christ Tompkins through the chair. I think there are, I don't know that there's been that conversation. I think it would be a challenging discussion to have. I think there's a difference between communities who choose, maybe in your mind, or you know, as you discuss communities who are not collecting what they could. There's a difference between communities that choose not to collect more, and that choice is probably, I mean, it could be based around services that the state's providing anyways. You know, where is there an incentive for them to tax local residents when the state's going to provide a service? There's a difference between that and communities who don't have the capacity to tax. And not because there's not a tax base, but because they're just simply so small in terms of their local government that they don't have the functionality to do so. And there's certainly probably more of those than there are of those who are choosing not to tax more. I think it's an interesting conversation to have in terms of, you know, how do you, you know, what does a local tax base look like? What, where is it maximized in terms of what a local government is retrieving from it? The same conversation could be had at the state level, but that's a different conversation, I think, Representative.
A good one, though.
Right. So, I mean, I think we'd be interested in talking more about what that looks like. But I think we wouldn't want to, you know, one, mandate or direct local governments to tax more to get some kind of additional benefit from the state. I think that needs to be a local decision. If you incentivize or, you know, increase their opportunity to take on powers in support of, you know, what the state's currently providing, I think that's a different piece. And maybe that's a future conversation.
Representative Jackson.
Thank you, through the chair. Very interesting question. And as you were talking about it, I'm thinking there is possible, or if you really think about, we are in a different time, and we do have to get more creative, but I'm thinking maybe you can see what you can let the small business or large businesses in your community do, right? Because that takes pressure off. It gives an option and also empowers the community because they're working and hiring more people. So it just gives a picture of more involved. Everyone has skin in the game, right?
Yeah, Representative Jackson through the chair. I think you're right that if there's a way to, you know, increase engagement, you know, throughout the community, that's important. But I did mention earlier that the legislature could act as the assembly of the unorganized borough. You could take up that question.
On that point in your previous discussion of the legislature acting as the unorganized borough and the three responsibilities associated with it, in what ways do you see the legislature as failing to execute those responsibilities or under executing?
I think that through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, I mentioned, I think, three mandatory requirements of a borough government. Education, which right now you delegate to DEED for REAAs, regional education attainment areas. The second would be platting, planning, zoning, which maybe DNR does a little bit of, but there's probably still work to do on that front. Taxation is the third responsibility of the assembly of the unorganized borough.
Back where we started. Last. Great. Thank you.
Yep. So community assistance, the base levels need to be there. You could increase the current base level for cities to $100,000, and that would benefit, I think, 100 out of 165 cities and boroughs. So there's definitely a small increase to the base level for cities is actually a huge increase for those communities. Road and rural airport maintenance has come up often. I've seen from DOT and in presentations to finance committees. There's also been discussion about how to shed those responsibilities for state government. I think there's a conversation to be had about what that looks like. So there's a difference between DOT interested in reducing service or its responsibilities for an airport. The city of there's a city in, I think, the Bristol Bay region for whom DOT recently listed as having transferred ownership to that city. The city never agreed to it. That's different than what we're talking about here, right? We're talking about the state and local government agreeing to that local government taking on more responsibilities. And I think, and we've heard that certainly from Anchorage's mayor, that, you know, if you gave us more funding for this, we would take on snow removal and road maintenance in Anchorage. I feel like I won't quote him on that, but he's said something along those lines. There's others certainly who are in a position to do that. And there are efficiencies, I think. You know, right now we have duplicative systems. You've got within any one community, you have state roads and city roads or borough roads. You have staff for each, you have equipment for each, you have plans and structures for each, and aligning those within a community makes a lot of sense. And I think there would very definitely be efficiencies for that. Need here, I based not on the STIP, so it's not a construction. I think that it's a national number. There's probably a better state number for what road mileage maintenance costs look like, and I think it's $28,000 is the national road mile maintenance number. So I just applied that to 5,500 local government roads, or if it's about that for state roads, then that doubles the amount. So I know that when we've talked to local governments about taking on more, it's an expensive endeavor. So I don't know that $100 million is the right number, but certainly this is an area where there's probably the most potential for actually devolution of state powers to local governments. Law enforcement certainly had a lot of attention in recent years, whether that's lack of law enforcement or deficient requirements for law enforcement. I first want to talk about community jails. So these are jails operated by local governments and for basically a state responsibility. That $7 million that they've received in the last 5 years, that's been a status quo amount. If you adjust for inflation, that's an amount that's still less than the 2002 levels. So we're putting less into community jails right now than we were in early 2000s when we faced a similar budget crisis. We're working with communities who are basically saying the state's putting in about half what we're spending on community jails. And I should just note that for local governments, they're not in charge of the court system, and they're not in charge of the laws that the legislature puts in place related to public safety. So, for instance, you know, the repeal of SB 91, whatever that looked like last year, a good step forward in a lot of ways, but that means that there's more people in these jails probably, and the state's not funding local governments for that addition. There's a broader vision or discussion here that's probably worth having. A lot of the discussion so far within the legislature has been focused on VPSOs, village police safety officers, and reductions from 13 million to 10 million or whatever that looks like. There hasn't been a single discussion about village police officers. And there's nothing the state puts in right now to local law enforcement, either for the 40 municipalities who spend $75 million more than the Department of Public Safety, or for the 35 municipalities who have village police officers who have 95 law enforcement or law officers who are struggling to make ends meet and, you know, need public safety. The troopers, between troopers and VPSOs, those aren't meeting community needs, and municipalities have taken on some of that responsibility. But there's nothing the state's putting in to that responsibility. And I think there's a good argument for the state incentivizing one, reimbursing and strengthening local law enforcement, especially for village police officers. And that could be as little as $30,000 per officer. That covers liability insurance. It covers bulletproof vest training, which right now is only offered one place, provided by a nonprofit, and costs $6,000 without travel. But that would mean a huge step to address public safety in Alaska, and it's currently not there at all. And there could be a conversation about how do you incentivize then the additional adoption of police powers by communities who currently have VPSOs. And instead of a $10 million budget line item, that base amount increases village police officers. A lot as part of that conversation, the need is estimated. it's hard to estimate any, but I mean, I think if you look at some of the, for those boroughs who have looked at adopting police powers, the studies that they have done have pointed to maybe a $30 million to $50 million investment that's required of them, a $30 or $50 million tax increase for residents. So I think you need some ability to offset those costs if you're going to see local governments take up more responsibilities. And there's a couple other items out there that the state currently funds, local emergency response, a couple other things that could be included in this.
Before you leave that slide, communities that have village police officers, they, to assume those policing powers, do they have to be a first-class city, a second-class city, or an organized borough?
They can be, Chair Hannon, they can be any of those, yeah. Any incorporated city or borough can adopt.
Any police. Incorporated. So even a third-class city can have exercise police powers.
I don't think there are any third-class.
Okay.
They exist in statute, but it's...
Okay.
Sorry, Chair Hannon. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Thaman.
Among some of the different slides, it seems like in ways the law enforcement function sometimes captures more of the community push. When there's dissatisfaction with the level of state service, people start saying, well, we'll start funding our own police officers. It's a significant cost to get started, and there's certainly numbers that do it. But it seems like that this gets to the core of your proposal, which is in some ways it seems like trying to convince the state to start providing a more sustainable funding stream in times of limited funding, so that municipalities that are trying to figure out where do we go with local policing, because we can see that the troopers aren't going to be providing the level of service that we want, and they're trying to figure out how much do we say to the public is it going to really cost, and if there's reliable state funding coming, say, to the tune of $30 million a year to a particular municipality or particular local government, then their taxing question to get police powers is very different than if they realize to do this there's no there might be state funding some years, but there might not be other years, and so if there's no reliable source, we have to really decide, are we going to take this on entirely ourselves? And boroughs and municipalities can do that, cities can do that, but it seems like the core of all this proposal is getting the state to start saying, okay, we really are going to provide a reliable stream so municipalities can plan, even though the trend that we're seeing is quite the opposite, that state funding is unreliable, and municipalities that can afford to are taking on more of the burden themselves and doing that, recognizing they're unlikely to the extent they get state support, it's not going to be reliable year after year. And I guess where does that then leave the municipalities and the boroughs and the cities that lack the ability to really come up with enough money to make it fly?
Right. Yeah, Representative Klayman, through the chair. I think between police and snow plowing, these are probably the two most visible elements for residents in terms of the heart of the proposal. There's certainly, I think we're at this transition point, right, which you speak to, where there's municipalities that recognize and are trying to come to grips with a state that's no longer there, either in its base levels of support or providing services that it had. They're being asked to take up more, but there needs to be some, you know, stepwise approach to how they can do that. And I think this suggests that, you know, maybe this is a sustainable funding path to getting to a place in the future where they've taken on more, that those startup costs to take on some of these things may be picked up by the state. Maybe there's match amounts in terms of what the local contribution is, and that you see that, just like school bond debt reimbursement or others, that those shift over time, but that you get to a point where that core level of service has been a partnership between the state and local governments versus an abrupt cost shifting, which is the pushback that we've seen over the last year. I'll talk about, I mean, there's plenty of concern at the local level about, you know, a new structure where if the state then decides, oh, we're out, that leaves them holding that responsibility. And I think, you know, that will have to be part of this conversation. How do we overcome what's, you know, right now a lack of trust in the state for keeping its piece of the agreement? But yeah, I mean, there's plenty of concern at the local side about what this would look like if the state chose to move a different way.
Representative Jackson, did you have a...
You caught the thought through the chair, so understand this thought is not an endorsement or not, but I think about, like, Eagle River wanting to break away from the municipality of Anchorage. And this could eventually happen in the valley as fast as they are growing. Does the municipal league support, like, areas wanting to become more independent because they feel like they can be more self-sufficient?
Representative Jackson, through the chair, I will not comment on the Anchorage experience directly, but I or the Eagle River intent directly. But I think that there's also plenty of communities out there that are unincorporated, and I would say that we have a resolution this last year that talks about how do we increase local control by taking on, you know, either incorporated or taking on new powers. So I think, you know, at that heart, that philosophy and that principle of local control really means incorporating as a city and taking on new powers. That's local control versus the state doing those things on your behalf. And I think there's certainly a tension there, but I can forward to this committee that resolution, which kind of walks through, you know, a stated philosophical belief about what local control looks like and where it is up to residents to figure out where they want to be in terms of their relationship with the city or borough.
Thank you.
Thank you. So what deferred building and K-12 maintenance. So I've the need here, $5 billion, is a combination of $3 billion in identified need for CIP projects submitted to us by cities and boroughs, plus the state's Department of Education, $2.3 billion in need for schools. There's a little bit of overlap, so maybe it's a wash. But right now, there's nothing on the state's in the state's approach that recognizes $3 billion in need for public buildings, public infrastructure provided by local governments. It's not on a deferred maintenance schedule. It's not anywhere in any agency. And I would suggest that it should be, as political subdivisions of the state should recognize that there is some level of need at the local level for deferred maintenance, for construction, for things that are essential for residents in Alaska. And then an assessment similar to what the Department of Education has is probably a good step. And there should be, I mean, for all the capital budgets that have produced that are produced each year, there is always some component that meets one need or another, you know, some portion of this already, and this is carving out specifically for those subdivisions, you know, what that should look like, similar to a University of Alaska's inclusion in the deferred maintenance schedule. At the same time, you have a K-12 construction and maintenance schedule, a six-year plan that's organized by the department. But 75% of those facilities are owned by municipalities. So I think there's really a new approach necessary to how we fund construction and maintenance of public infrastructure in the state, and not just that owned by the state. So this speaks to that and potentially move some of those aspects from agency level work to local governments to take on. I don't necessarily have an answer to what happens in the REAAs, but right now that's entirely the responsibility of the Department of Education, and maybe there's a new approach to how that's done. Senior property tax exemption reimbursement, we already talked about this. The need is $90 million. If our position has been that, and we are probably the only ones that bring this up to the legislature over the last 20 years, but also that's our job to say, I mean, here's an unfunded mandate that should be funded and is required to be funded in statute. So including this as part of the community dividend means that local governments have greater decision making, can take on more if they want to, and also, you know, reduce taxes or, you know, make decisions that are entirely in the interest of their local government. Fairbanks right now gives a good example of their tax base increasing this year, but because of the exemption, they actually get less tax revenue. And so it is very different by city or borough in terms of how this, the impacts that this has. Water and wastewater upgrades. I didn't have this in here last year or when I originally kind of worked through this. But the need here, the $3 billion, there's a list that IHS, Indian Health Service, maintains, submitted by, I think, DEC, that has about $1.6 billion in need just for rural Alaska. And you can imagine that for urban communities, there's another billion plus, I think, just to upgrade municipality of Anchorage's water and wastewater system is about $1 billion probably. Right now, there are 65 communities that don't have to meet the requirements of the Clean Water Act, so they don't have to upgrade their systems. But if they did have to, and if you would like them to, then there needs to be more investment in this. And the investment right now provided by the state is only through the revolving loan fund, which is successful, and then through the state match for federal funds for Village Safe Water. Here's a big need that's not currently being addressed. Representative Klayman, you brought up earlier, you know, what happens if, and so variation in decision making is something to pick up at some point. This is how do we mitigate risks to both parties How do we mitigate risk for local governments who take on new responsibilities, and how do we manage risk at the state level to the extent that you're devolving some of those responsibilities? And so people have said, you know, what happens if the earnings, the POMV increases a significant amount, and instead of $586 million that the local governments are allocated, it's $1 billion. And probably the state would want some ability to manage that process. Similarly, if the POMV decreased to an extent that $586 million wasn't available, what does that look like? And so I think you'd have to work through, you know, how do you have regular CPI increases for funding for programs? What's an appropriate level of increased funding for projects that you've carved out based on a percentage? And maybe some excess goes into a municipal capital projects fund if there is $5 billion in need. And if the POMV decreased, maybe there's flat funding or there's no new bonding for different things, but that you put in place formulas for decreases as needed. That there should be something like a hold harmless provision, so that if a municipality takes on a power or a program, that it can't be left funded, and maybe out of that percentage that comes in, there's a floor of $200 million, or, you know, pick a number that represents a floor, so that those programs continue to have base levels of funding and a commitment by the state that that's in place. And I say this later, but I mean, it's entirely possible that as new powers are taken on, or if there are existing powers, that if funding goes away, municipalities can give those powers up just as easily, and the responsibility reverts back to the state to take those on. So when you have a community that shuts down, that means they're not doing REAA elections for the Division of Elections anymore. That means they're probably not doing animal control. They're not doing VPOs. And any cost that's not being provided at the local level, or any service that's not being provided at the local level that's a state responsibility, reverts to the state when it's not funded by the state.
Has the Municipal League engaged in any other, in establishing a community services fund, any other revenue streams, like, say, an income tax, but instead of it being, you know, based on income of everyone statewide, but maybe calling it a community services tax, and that money being collected by the state to give to municipalities to carry out their duties? Or have we only, has the discussion solely been around the dividend and POMV structure for a place to come up with a local government apportionment?
Yeah. Chair Hannon, there are certainly different ways to get to this other than through the POMV or the earnings reserve. Right now, the state is the only level of government, I mean, outside the federal government, able to do an income tax, to do a net income tax. The state statute currently preempts local government from implementing an income tax, so it would have to be a state decision to do that. But there's definitely an argument for, if there were an income tax, that would meet these needs, both in terms of level of funding, from what I've seen, and apportionment of where income is derived from, that basically the formulas here are those with greater populations are going to be able to take on more responsibilities, and probably it's their citizens being taxed. So there's definitely something to that. It's also true that the state preempts local governments from taxing the value of resources, so oil, gas, mineral. I mean, there's other ways to get to that, but
right. Yeah. And I guess in my mind, I especially think of when dialogues about an income tax, I think of all the income earned by non-resident workers,
right,
many of them in rural communities, you know, whether it's a fish plant or mine, and that dedicating that revenue earned in that region back to those communities that may not have an otherwise property tax basis to generate the revenue to do local powers. But there's a stream of it. But I just didn't know whether, when AMLs had these dialogues about a community services fund, whether it's really just been around the division of the permanent fund investment funds and revenue, or whether other streams of income to produce that fund have been dialogued about.
Thank you, Chair Hannon. Yeah, we haven't talked about it directly. And I mean, the community dividend and its many iterations over decades has always been based on that resource revenue and the ability for the state to redistribute it through something like this. So it's always been focused on the dividend. It's really hard from the outside to say what a state fiscal note looks like. I'm not the Department of the Office of Management and Budget. It should be the intent behind this to save the state money. It should be part of the intent behind this, that given the fiscal situation, that if there's not savings to the state, then you know probably a lot of this doesn't make sense. It's a harder argument if I'm just here saying increase local control.
Representative Christoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To clarify that statement, savings to the state. So state budget reduction of 50 to 100 million, is that net savings to the state in terms of looking at the outlay of community dividends relative to operating budget reductions, including what's enumerated on this slide?
Through the chair, Representative Christ-Tompkins, that would be the intent. I think we'd have to get to some number like that to make it justifiable for you beyond this makes sense for local governments. It needs to make sense to you too. So the total outlay from the state in terms of reallocating what you're currently providing to some of these programs versus a community dividend will be much more than this. But in terms of the savings to state operating costs, I think, yes, you want to get to something like this and reducing administrative costs across departments, which I think gets picked up by local governments in a lot of ways. It's a harder discussion to and harder for me to know, you know, what does this mean for downsizing Department of Education or DOT or Department of Public Safety. But I think those should be conversations that, as part of this. And if part of the goal during a time of fiscal crisis is to reduce the size of state spending to the extent you can and the state footprint, this maybe helps to meet that need.
To get to a savings of 50 to 100 million on the state budget, wouldn't that really require the state to put a fairly substantial amount into the fund so that the income you're earning off of the fund that's being held in the structure you're proposing would actually pay out that much money? Because if we're only talking about savings, just say in road maintenance and police protection, the two most popular items that we were talking about, if we're really just talking about reducing those appropriations, then the municipalities and the cities are going to be saying, well, where's the money? We only achieve the savings if we put a chunk of money in and then you're getting income through this program to pay those expenses. Am I missing something or have I got that right?
Yeah. Representative Klayman, through the chair, I think this number is based on looking at a number of different departments and, you know, assuming maybe a 10% reduction in administration. So I think that's how we got to this number. This is certainly an area where we would have to work through exactly, I mean, do a fiscal and an economic analysis of savings at the state level and increased costs at the local level. So I don't know that I can answer your question or respond to your point as clearly as I'd like to at this point.
Follow up?
Certainly.
It just strikes me if the savings are all achieved through efficiencies and reduced management and administration expenses in all these different departments, if you started at the low end of $50 million and if you estimated that a person effectively costs the state $100,000 per person on average, it's like 5,000 I may not be doing my math right, but it's not 100,000, but it's like, we're not talking we're talking hundreds of people are going to be losing their jobs with these new efficiencies that are being gained. And I guess I'm a little bit skeptical that the state bureaucracy or the state functioning is that bloated with folks doing work. I've had some meetings with staff from Deed just recently, and it sounded like their actual staff membership in Deed is like less than 10.
Right.
And so I think, okay, so if you're going to reduce that by, there's not 10 people in Deed unless you completely eliminate the department to achieve those savings. So I guess I'm skeptical about how you achieve that through just increased efficiency.
Right. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Klayman, I would say one of the reasons this is a working draft is we'd love to work on that with you. And I think it really is hard to do it from the outside, that without the apparatus, of either legislative research or finance or an OMB at our disposal, we don't have the same kind of access to some of those numbers. And I think that's part two of why to start this conversation. I think we want to include it because this should be part of the goal. But what it looks like on the other end is entirely what goes, what's part of it, what are the details, what are the mechanisms, and what can both sides agree to. So I will. I know that didn't answer your question necessarily, but it's a stepping off point, right? We're on a journey.
Right. I guess I'll go ahead and comment. I look at it and go, and is it, we used some rhetoric last year of saving the state money or cutting the state budget, but it was just really a cost shift. So is this, in that budget last year, the proposal was you're taking things and you're saying we're saving the state money, but we're just putting them on municipal governments to provide. And mm-hmm. to some degree, this feels a little bit like similar. We're saving the state money, but we didn't save the state's residents any money. It's just they're now paying them at a local government level instead of the state level. But the goal is from the Municipal League to seek a more efficient operation of local delivery of snow plowing.
Sure. Yeah, thank you, Chair. This is the third bullet point. So, there's one argument where, yes, it reduces state spending or the state government footprint. But there's also, you're just moving it to the local level. So in terms of overall government, there's probably still about that same size government. Hopefully you can find efficiencies in that transfer. But there's also, varying political views about why to do one or the other or not. So it's part of the conversation. But I think this, it does clarify and redefine if we're part of a point now where there's a transition either occurring because that's where we're at or because we want to be intentional about it. This sets some intentionality around here's where we're headed. We want to see a different kind of partnership with local governments. It definitely fits into the conversation being had by the legislature right now about how to allocate the POMV draw between different state, local individuals. Ultimately, for us, it maximizes local government. It increases local capacity and helps us in being, I think, political subdivisions of the state that are doing more for the state. It doesn't all have to happen at once. I recognize that it's a very big, convoluted idea. I talked about step one, step two in terms of the bringing in current fund transfers into a governance structure that you're comfortable with. I think doing all of it at once is difficult to see, maybe. But maybe there's a step in the right direction that we could take now toward figuring out a governance structure and how to find efficiencies that we could kind of phase in other elements over time and build on the experience that we have early on. That said, we can also stand things up pretty quickly, and we've proven that through programs like the AML Joint Insurance Association, which is statute driven, the AML Investment Pool, which is statute driven. our current work in setting up an Alaska Remote Seller Sales Tax Commission, and basically doing centralized administration for sales tax collection for online sales in the state. So we know how to do this in bringing together and pulling together an interlocal administration. And right now those are really effective and affordable ways to deliver services for local governments and on behalf of Alaska residents. So thank you.
Any questions, comments? On behalf of the committee, Mr. Andreessen, thank you very much for kicking us off with a meaty topic for our intellectual processing over the remainder of the session, or maybe till we have a resolution for you. Our next House Community and Regional Affairs meeting is scheduled for Thursday morning at 8 in this room. We'll hear House Bill 221, State Recognition of Tribes, and House Bill 193, a second verse to Alaska's state song.
We have to sing it?
Yeah.
Only if we want to torture each other. Representative Jackson sings beautifully. I, on the other hand, am told not to sing when there's anyone else in the car. So I am more than happy to have Representative Jackson sing both verses of the Alaska flag song. Anything else for the committee? Again, thank you, Mr. Andreessen, for the Municipal League's work to keep our communities functioning, and I'm going to gavel us out at 9:53. There's my gavel.